Commandments and looking at that, in part trying to think about how the Ten Commandments are a scaffolding or kind of a structure on which the rest of the Old Testament and at some level the New Testament is built upon. When Julie and I moved into our house, we decided to remodel, and the interior of the house was built in 1920, and native cut red oak, rough cut red oak was the studs in the house. I didn't know this. A lot of you may know it already. I didn't know it, but wood gets harder once you build it into a house every year. It just keeps getting a little harder, getting a little harder, getting a little harder. And this is 100-year-old native cut red oak on the house. And so even with a nail gun, we had to be careful because the nail would want to shoot out sideways and give us trouble. And that's what our house is built. I mean, the very center of the house, good foundation, and this really, really, really crazy, stupid hardwood. And so the house, you know, even though there's other things in the house you might worry about, you feel pretty good about the interior, you know. And the Ten Commandments, at some level, are the interior for the rest of our faith. I mean, it's kind of what it's all built upon. And we've been working through the different commands and trying to figure out what it is that God's saying, not only directly to the Jewish people of that time, but again, as that scaffold, you know, as those studs underneath, what he's building us up into. And the verse today is no false testimony, don't be a false witness against your neighbor. Probably some newer Bibles might just simplify it and say, don't lie. You know, if you want to be a follower of God, if you want to be a follower of Jesus Christ, then don't lie. And so I was getting ready for the sermon, and I went online, and I looked up, I typed in famous liars. Thought that'd be interesting, you know, famous liars. And it was, and I knew a lot of the liars that were, I mean, because they're famous, right? I mean, I knew a lot of them and what they were famous for. But there were a couple that I didn't know very well. This guy popped up pretty early. And some of you guys might know him right off, but some of you might not. Carlo Pietro Giovanni Tebaldo Ponzi is his name. And you know the last name. You know the rest of it, but you know the last name. And in the 20s, he had this scheme where he would set up investments for people, and they could give him their money, and he promised a 100% return in 90 days. And what he did was, new guys who came in and paid their money in, he took their money, and he just gave lots of it he said that was the investment. So like the new guys came in, he paid the old guys with it and kept a slice for himself. And this is during his heyday here. He's got a real nice tie and hat on, and he bought him a mansion, and he was really the toast of the town. Everybody thought he was a genius, that he had figured something out that nobody else had ever figured out. But it was all a lie. It was all a scam. It was all made up. At the height of it, he was taking in $100,000 a day in 1920 dollars. He was taking in $100,000 a day, a little more than that, at the very height of the deal. And when it all came falling apart, it fell apart real fast. A newspaper in Boston figured it out and published articles about it, and it almost all disappeared immediately. And again, he got from being like one of the richest guys in the city, and now when people know his name, Ponzi, it's about that scheme where you take money from the new guys to give to the old, and it's not real. It's all a lie, but people keep falling for it. He didn't just lie, but set up a whole system of lying. And I had heard of him. I had forgotten about this next one. And maybe you remember or know it right off and recognize it. It's a name, Rosie Ruiz. And she wasn't famous to me, but she won the Boston Marathon. And at the time, her finish time was a record time. No lady had ever ran it that fast. And the reason she was able to do that is because she didn't run the Boston Marathon. She started the Boston Marathon, and then she cut across, and about a half mile from the end, she took off again, jumped in out of the crowd and started running, and she crossed first, and looks like she's about to fall down, but she was fine. In fact, one of the reporters said, "You don't look like you're sweating," and she goes, "Yeah, it's just training, you know, just a lot of good training, eating well, that kind of thing," and they were suspicious right off, partly because of the sweating thing. Partly because she didn't seem to know anything about competitive running. One reporter from like Runner's World magazine asked her, "You know, what were your intervals?" And she said, "What's an interval?" She didn't know what that was. And you may not know what that is either, but runners would know what that was. And that seemed suspicious. And it all came falling down. Now she never denied it. She never admitted it. even when there was evidence, people remembered her jumping out of the crowd at half mile to go. The people remembered it. They did an investigation. She qualified for the Boston Marathon because she finished like 11th in the New York City Marathon. And so they went back and investigated that after it all came out. And they found out that she was lying then too. That the people remembered her riding the subway during the marathon. Like she went from one place. She still had her number on. And they would ask her, hey, what's going on? You got your number on for the race. Oh, yeah, I sprained my ankle. I'm just going to go to the end and see who won, she told them. But they remembered seeing her. And that all came falling apart too. And she never admitted it. And because she never admitted it, I'm sure there were people who believed her till the very end. Thought it was awful they took her trophy away. Thought it was awful they took away her prize. If you are a competitive person or a runner or something, the lady who finished second also was the fastest time ever. But no one even talked to her for about 2 or 3 weeks till they figured out this other thing. Her big moment of glory, she never really got that because the other lady lied. And she never really admitted it. She never confessed. She never never said that any part of it was even when the evidence, she just, nah, it's all made up. It's all, everybody's a conspiracy against me. Lies can do fantastic damage. And we've all felt those. We've all had people who lied to us, who we believed in, who we thought were honest or were doing us right, and they didn't. You know, they weren't being honest. They weren't being true, even though we thought they were. We a lot of people, if I were to survey the crowd here today, will say, I don't ever get my news from that source, whatever that source is, you know, Fox News or CNN or MSNBC or some internet site. I never get my news there because they lie. You know, I can't trust them. And I don't trust this other group. I don't trust that they're going to tell me the truth. And we all know what that feels like. We all know what it feels like to have certain people in our life who they've lied to us 2 or 3 times. And it's just hard to have me. Maybe in your family. You know, especially painful if you have a parent or a spouse who lies a lot. It's really hard to hold a family together when you have somebody cheating that way. And we know what it's like in a church. I mean, it's kind of a cliche to say there's hypocrites in church, but I mean, we all know that. Rich Mullins kind of famously said that the church is not full of hypocrites. We always have room for one more. And I thought that was a good line. But we know that's true, right? I mean, there's a lot of hypocrites in church, and there's some casual hypocrisy with most of us, you know, where we fall short of this target we set for ourselves. We all are guilty of that, but there are some in here who, you know, who really have a double life going, and they're one person when they're here, and they're another person when they're not here. Maybe another person at school than they are here. And then there's that weird moment when you're at the football game with your friends and some old fella from church sees you, wants to say hi, and the worlds are colliding, and how are you going to get around that? Or maybe somebody from your work shows up to visit here at church some Sunday, and they know you at work, and now they're going to see you here at church, and it's two different people, and the tension of that, you know. It's real exhausting to try to live that double life, but people do it. And we all know what the damage of all that is. But even though we know the damage of that, even though we all know it, and even though we all feel it, and even though we all could testify about it, that God is right, it's very easy to fall into that. And that's why the commandment is there. And so what we want to talk about today is what the commandment means broadly. You already know most of that, but what it means broadly. And then also kind of expectations for us as Christians. What kind of people are we supposed to be understanding that? Jesus says about himself, I'm the way and the truth and the life. Not only Jesus says, am I teaching you truth? I am truth. He says, there's no hypocrisy in me. He says, if you watch me live my life, you're going to see that I'm consistent 100% of the time. And it's interesting, as a side note here, well, it's interesting to me that no one ever catches him at that. You know, like if I were to get up and say, not only am I teaching you the truth, I am the truth. I'll never violate what I say. Well, I mean, it wouldn't take you 2 hours to find out that wasn't true. You just follow me around. You'd say, sooner or later, I'd do something, you know. Sooner or later, I'd make some mistake. I would. And it wouldn't take you that long to find out that I wasn't 100%. But Jesus would say stuff like this, and they never catch him at it. When Jesus finally is put on the cross, it mentions it in the Gospels. They have to bring out false witnesses. They have to bring out guys who are on purpose going to lie about it to get him on the cross because he's never inconsistent. They do call him names, the guys who don't like Jesus. They do call him names, but they never call him a hypocrite. And I think that's interesting. It's a subtle thing about Jesus that stands out to me. But Jesus says, not only is he the truth, but he says the things that I'm teaching, if you'll hold on to that, then you're really my disciples. You'll know the truth, he says, and the truth will set you free. So, certainly free from that double world problem, you know, where people who know you in one world meet people who know you in the other, and the tension and that weighs on us, and how that can hurt, you know, we're trying to get all the worlds together there. It sets you free from remembering all your lies, remembering what you told one person. You know, you might make some little lie to get out of trouble here or get out of trouble there, and then you got to keep that up. We were talking about this in one of my small groups I go to, and somebody said that he didn't want to go to school, so he signed up for school, but he never went. And his parents, all semester, they'd ask him about it. Hey, how's school going? Great. You know, he'd have to tell his whole story. Great lecture today. I really learned a lot. And he's just making it all up. It's not true at all. I would think that a story like that might be a lie, except I've heard that story before from other people. My nephew went to school at IU, and his roommate had a full ride to IU, a scholarship going to pay for everything, and his roommate never left the room the whole semester. He played World of Warcraft the whole time. He never left. He was an orc or something, and he played computer games the whole time. And his parents would call, and he would just make up stories. You know, how's class going? Great. Learning a lot. But sooner or later, the report card comes out. Sooner or later, there's going to be evidence. And all those lies fall down. And the stress of keeping all those lies going, Jesus says, I come to set you free from that. You don't have to go that direction. You don't have to live like that. And again, remembering that the Ten Commandments are kind of a scaffold that we build everything else on. One of the keys to living a God-honoring life is to just be who you say you are. Have integrity. You know, if this is important to you, then live like it's important to you. You don't need to be two different people. You don't need to pretend. Just be authentic. And we can take your bad side. And some of the people who you hang out with who don't know the Lord, they can take this part of you too. They can. Just have integrity. So, the command. Let's look at the command. It says, bear no false witness against your neighbor. Probably when the command was first put out, the main agenda of it was like courtroom testimony stuff. If you're called to testify, be honest. Don't get bribed. Don't allow yourself to get swayed because one person's more popular than another. If you're called to testify in a court, you have to tell the truth. And there's other verses, like in Deuteronomy, where it says if you get up in a court and you testify against somebody and you're lying and it's proven that you're lying, you're going to get whatever punishment they would have got. So if you're in a death penalty kind of conversation and they find out you're lying, then you're going to get the death penalty for lying. Whatever it is you're accusing them of, you're going to get the punishment for that. And they took it really serious. In a world before DNA testing or videotapes or different things, I mean, people's word really mattered. And one liar could really wreck not only your trust in them, but your trust in the whole system. And probably when this first came out, that was the idea. That word for false there, it means it's a Hebrew word, shakir, and it kind of means deceptive, but also treacherous. Like, it's not just an accident, like you forgot and you told it wrong. It's you're actively trying to hurt someone else. You're actively trying to say something to knock them down. And Jesus said, we just can't be that kind of people. When Jesus expands on that idea, he does it by saying that you'll know the truth. And the truth, in that same section where he says the truth will set you free, he says the devil was a murderer from the beginning. He didn't hold the truth. There's no truth in him. And when he lies, he just speaks his native language. He's a liar. Father lies. I did a sermon or two about the devil a couple of years ago, and I talked about this then, but it does bear some mentioning again. So if it's all familiar, just bear with me, and I'll try to chew through it real fast. When it says he lies, it's not so much that he tells outlandish things. Because you'd see right through that. There's a giraffe in your room. Well, I mean, there's not. I can see it. You know, or your mother was taken by aliens. No, she's right there. I mean, it won't be those kinds of lies, right? It won't be like crazy, outlandish, stupid things, because you can prove those things. It'll be little half-truths twisted to the worst possible outcome. Now, I wrote down some just so I wouldn't forget. The devil might tell you that you're only worthwhile, you're only good as long as you're producing. A kid could feel that, you know, like a mom and dad only really like me if I'm winning, if my team wins, or if I get good grades, or if as long as I'm producing, they like me. If I don't produce, they don't like me. And there's probably some half-truth in that. Maybe they really brag on you when you do well, and the pressure of that's kind of gotten into your head. But the rest of it, that's just a lie. It's the devil twists it just a little bit to try to ruin you. You might get this lie that there's something about you that's undesirable or ugly or unattractive. And because that undesirable, unattractive thing is part of your life, no one's ever going to really like you or love you. You're always going to be. And I've seen people hear that lie and it gets in their head. And again, it's a half-truth. I mean, all of us have some little thing that we wish was different. But the devil will take that half-truth and he'll just amplify it to where it's all you can think about. And then you start to blame it. Well, no wonder I can't find somebody because whatever this is. Or no wonder my life is hard because of whatever this thing is. It starts with a little lie, and then it just becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. The devil might lie to you and say, hey, you married the wrong one. You know, if you'd have been smarter, you'd have went for that other person. That was the one you wanted to be with. But now you chose wrong. Because you chose wrong, that one mistake is just going to haunt you. You know, and there, you need to get out because you chose the wrong one. And again, you might have chosen somebody who wasn't a finished product. You might have chosen somebody who there's a little bit of a mess to them. You might have even chosen somebody who was putting on a really good face for you when that wasn't really how they are. That happens all the time. I mean, that's how people always do. That's how they act. In fact, it'd be hard to find a couple where that didn't happen, right? A guy who barely wears deodorant is suddenly putting on cologne whenever he goes out to be with, you know, really putting on a good face. There was a lady that I knew who, when she started dating her future husband, he was a big hunter, and she would go on and on about how much fun it was to go out with him while he shot things. Just so much fun to be there and watch him shoot. I just get, you know, vapors just watching you get out there and shoot things. And it's a lie, right? But it's the kind of lie you tell because you're trying to get close to somebody, you know. And then after they got together, they married, like on the second or third anniversary, he bought her a gun, thinking that was a good gift. And it wasn't a good gift because she was lying about the whole thing. She didn't mean it. It was all made up. It was all, but that's the kind of lie people do. And so maybe you had those kind of lies happen to you, you know. And so now the devil takes that thing, where there's a little half-truth in it. He says, oh, yeah, you married the wrong one. You married the wrong one, and now you're stuck. And if that lie really gets into your head, you can justify all sorts of bad behavior. That's the kind of lies the devil tells. He tries to get you to live in this false reality. It's just not truth. It's not real. Dallas Willard had a quote about this. He says, truth reveals a reality. And reality can be described as what we humans run into when we're wrong. It's a collision in which we always lose. Reality is what you run into when you're wrong. Reality is spending a whole semester playing World of Warcraft and then the report card comes in and your parents are reading it. That's reality. Reality is telling some lie to your spouse. You know, did you take care of all those things I asked you to do? Oh, yeah, sure. What things? Yeah, I got them all done. And then reality is getting home together and they know you didn't. Reality is you promised to do something, or you said you'd be somebody, or you acted like you were taking care of things and you didn't, and everybody knows. And everybody can see it. You know, that one lie that you married the wrong person. Person might take that lie in their head and justify running around. And when it comes out, and it always comes out, and everybody can see you, that's reality. Reality is what we hit when it all finally comes to be exposed. So why then does anybody get into these holes? I'm sure everything I'm telling you is common sense, right? There's nothing I've told you today that you didn't already know. I mean, so why then do people find themselves in this place if this is so obvious? And it's just because it's hard to be right. It's hard to do the right thing. It's hard to be righteous. It's hard to follow Jesus. Our own natural heart. One of the big lies the devil tells is you got to be true to yourself. You got to be true to yourself. To your own heart be true. That's what Shakespeare said. And you got to be true to you. Follow your heart. That's this crazy lie. Your heart is often wrong. Your heart is mostly wrong. The Bible says the heart is deceitful above all things. Who can understand it? If you try, and when Shakespeare said, to thine own heart be true, he puts that speech, that line, is in the hands of a fool. The guy who said it is known to be the fool in that play. It's terrible advice. If you follow your own heart, you're going to fall prey to all sorts of stupid animal instincts that aren't going to take you where you want to go. And so there's this temptation, right? I want to do the bad thing, or I want to be right, but I also want to do the bad thing. And the temptation can be so strong, if you don't watch it, you'll lie. I found this thing, it passes around sometimes on social media, like Facebook and places like that. It's Leo Tolstoy. He wrote in his diary, September 19th in 1858, he wrote down that he had decided that one must love and work, and that's it. And then the very next day, he writes down that he was tired, and so he didn't love or he didn't work. And that's the problem, right? I know what I should do, I just don't want to do it. And there's a temptation in that moment to lie. And really, those are the kind of lies that I want to focus on the most, because those are the lies that do the most damage. When Jesus says in his line, if you told my teaching, you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Jesus is laying out for you a mental map, like a road map. And if you'll follow this road map, you will get to where you want to go. You'll have a life that's a transformative life. You won't be dependent on anybody. You'll be unencumbered. Right? There's nothing holding you down. He says, if you'll follow my roadmap here, you'll have the very best kind of life. The life that you've always wanted, a life of integrity and a life of authenticity. You'll know the truth and it'll save you. You won't get caught in little deceptions. Now, as I'm saying this, it's possible, maybe even likely, that one or two of you are thinking of little deceptions, little things you hold back from the people that you love. I mean, maybe one or two of you are thinking of some pretty big things that have become problems. I just think this is the kind of thing that we want to strive very hard to correct, even if that involves a painful apology this afternoon. I think it's the kind of thing that we want to correct, because the sooner we can get ourselves back into the truth, the better off we'll be. Our words have weight. When we say the things that we say, whether they're truth or lie, they have weight. They carry on. They continue to matter long after we said it. And people form opinions. When I stand in front of the church, we were in Scottsburg, Indiana, Julia and I stood in front of the church, and I say I do, that word, it has weight, and it lasts much longer than that ceremony. You know? That word has weight, and it continues to have weight later on. That promise that I made to Julia, my kids adopt that promise. I never really said anything to them. I never said an I do to them, but they're part of that whole contract. And my kids come in, and I've made promises to them from that one I do all those years ago. And they come to count on those promises, and they build their life based on how I honor my promises, based on how I hold up to what I said I would do. My words aren't empty. They have power. If I name something, if I name a person something, or if I name, I mean, that name continues to carry weight. Some casual insult that I might do, some little dig I might make to somebody else, it continues to carry on long after I said it. They're still thinking about it. And so I got to guard my speech. I know the words I say are going to last lots longer than I intend. As an illustration of that, it's more of a history thing. Thomas Jefferson, when he wrote down all men are created equal, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. When he wrote those words down, what he meant was King George thinks he can rule us because he's a special kind of human. And Jefferson said, he's no more special than me. And he's no more special than the guys who are writing this down. He didn't believe the slaves should all be freed because he kept slaves. He wasn't trying to make a big speech about human equality. He was talking about a king and whether a king had a right to rule. That's all he was really talking about. He writes this down. But the words have weight. And when Lincoln quoted those words in the Gettysburg Address, you know, that we are a nation dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. What Lincoln took those words to mean is that Jefferson was saying something deeper than he understood. Lincoln took those same words and said, slaves should be free. There shouldn't be slavery. When Martin Luther King came 100 years later and said that I have a dream that this nation will rise up one day to understand and live out the true meaning of its creed, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. When King quoted that, he meant not only should black people be free, but we should be equal. He's putting meaning to the words that Jefferson never intended, but that's how words are. Once you put the words out there, they just keep going. And they last, and they have weight, and they matter. And the truths that we tell and the lies that we tell, Augustine did a whole thing about this, and he says, all lies are bad, but some lies are worse. When we tell a lie to cut someone down, to gossip or slander, and I've been the victim of that. I'm not going to have you raise your hand, but a lot of you guys have been the victim of that, right? I mean, we all know what that feels like. When somebody cuts my reputation or they say something about me to somebody else, they say some things that aren't true, they lie with an intent to hurt me, it's real hard to recover from that. Sometimes you can't recover from it. If someone says that I did this awful thing or I thought this awful thing or I was part of this awful thing, if I go to them and say, hey, I know you heard this rumor, but it's not true, they're thinking just exactly what a guilty person would say, you know, and they don't believe it. When I tell lies to hurt someone else, that's a terrible kind of lie. When I tell lies that'll benefit me but make somebody else lose, Augustine said those are the worst kind of lies. You know how we so casually tell some truth out there to hurt. Augustine said the worst kind of lies are when we tell lies about God. And again, if you think about the devil telling lies, I think that's his worst kind of lie, is to tell you lies about God, to make you think that God is a certain way that he isn't, or that God thinks a certain way that he doesn't. Those kind of lies can really do some damage. Think about the prodigal son story. If you remember the prodigal son story, a man has two sons. The older son thinks that dad is hard, that dad is always demanding. And so what he does is he works hard. He really grinds it out, man. He works long hours. He comes in after the sun goes down and he gets up and he starts working before the sun comes up and he's intense, you know. He never takes breaks. Other guys will take breaks and go party with their friends. He never takes breaks. He thinks dad is hard and so he focuses, you know, 100%. It's a lie he's been told. The younger son also thinks dad's hard. He just all the time thinks dad's so hard and so mean and so tough. And so he decides to run away. He's not going to stay and put up with dad and dad's rules. And for a while it goes pretty well for the younger son. You know, it's a lot of fun to party. But when the money all runs out, he runs into reality. Reality is always there like a concrete wall to run into. And he's going full speed when he hits reality. And all of his friends leave, and he loses his house, and he's feeding another guy's pigs. And one day while he's feeding the pigs, he starts getting hungry for what the pigs are eating. He's just so hungry. And he remembers his dad. And he thinks to himself, you know, dad was pretty hard, but at least people had food. And dad was pretty hard, but at least I had a roof over my head. And here I am in this pig pen. And so he decides to walk back. And he's going to go talk to his dad and say, dad, I'm just sorry for, you know, I don't expect to go back and be a son again. I'll just live in with the slaves, you know. And he's not going because he's changed his mind. He still thinks dad's hard. That's still a lie that he believes. He still thinks that dad is tough and mean. And what he expects dad to do when he gets back is to make him crawl, you know. Crawl up and say, oh, you know, I can't believe I said this awful thing to you, and I'm so sorry. And dad will say, yeah, I knew you'd come crawling back. And dad may sneer at him and say, yeah, you can go work with the slaves. He's ready to do that. I'll just work with the slaves. So sorry. And I talk to people sometimes, even Christians, who get into fights with people, and they'll say that. They'll say things. I mean, they won't say it like that, but they'll say, like, you know, I'll forgive them. I'll forgive them as soon as they come back and, you know, crawl. As soon as they come back and really, you know, let me know that they've changed. Well, then maybe I'll let them go. And the younger son thinks dad's like that. And so he starts walking back, and he still smells like pigs, you know. And he tops the hill of his father's house, and dad sees him. You know, maybe dad's on the porch, or maybe he's working with the animals or something, but he sees him, and he sees him at a long distance. And so it probably because of how the boy walks, right? You know, some people have a certain walk. You can just tell when you see them who they are. And he sees him, and dad takes off running. And he grabs the boy up and he hugs him. And the boy can't believe it. So he goes through his apology. He says, you know, dad, I'm so sorry, and I've made all these mistakes. I'll be your son, I'll be a slave. And dad's not even listening. He tells his servants, he says, go get a ring for his finger and shoes for his feet and go kill the fattened calf, and we're gonna have a party. My son is alive again, he's found, and they have this huge party. When the older brother, who also thinks dad is hard, he's been out working hard all night, and he comes back and he sees this party, it just makes him mad. And it's weird. It makes it, like, he can see the party. The younger son can see the party. I picture the younger son's inside, and it's like, man, what is going on? I mean, what is happening? And the older brother, he sees it too, and he's mad. Yeah, I'm out there killing myself. I know how hard you are. And dad's like, why do you think I'm so hard? Can I tell you what's up and down? Can I tell you what's right and wrong? Is that why you think I'm hard? I think there's people in here that think that God is so hard, you know? God puts all these rules and all this stuff on me, and it's just so much, and he's not that hard. He loves you. I've had to go to a lot of funerals this week. A lot of hard stories. And it makes you think, you know. It really puts it in your head. Am I ready? And it makes me think anyway about the end and what's going to happen. And I remain convinced that a lot of people are going to be more surprised about God's grace at the end than you would imagine. I mean, there will certainly be people surprised about judgment. There will certainly be people who are surprised about the reality, you know, heaven and hell, when they die and they run into that reality. That there's going to be people shocked for that, for sure. But I think there's going to be a lot of people stunned that God is running towards them. You're expecting to have God make you crawl for 1,000 years, and he's got this whole party waiting on the other side. That the reason why he put the rules out there is it's just the best way to live. And he wouldn't have you suffer. And he loves you. The biggest lie that we live is this lie that I don't need anything but myself, that I can rely on my own heart to guide me, and I don't need any help from anybody. And the people who believe that are legion. And all of them, me included, have different stories of running into the wall of reality, of getting knocked backwards. And a lot of people, when that happens, they wake up and they turn to God and they ask God to carry them and find that he's willing to do that and he wants to. Other people just get up and start running hard as they can to the next wall. And when you come in here today, this can be reality, but a soft wall. And it can be a chance for you to wake up and say, I just want to know the Lord who cares so much about me. He's the truth. He's the ultimate reality. And one day all of us are going to stand in front of him. So we best be ready for that. And you don't have to go to him thinking he's going to make you grovel. He's willing to take anybody there who wants to go. So as we finish up our time together, I'm going to pray for you. And if anybody wants to draw close to God today, for whatever reason, I'll have people up here in the front who'll be praying. And I just encourage you to come pray with them. Won't you stand up? Let's pray together. Dear Lord God, I thank you for this group. I ask you, God, as we finish up our time together, that you help us to draw close. And for anybody here, God, who just wants to know you better, I pray that you make that possible, that you hear our prayers and that you show us, God, your patience and your grace for we sinners who are doing the best we can. In Jesus' name, amen.